Appeals. We have two cases set for submission this morning for oral argument and several cases set for submission on the briefs. And if counsel's ready, I'll ask the clerk to call our first case.
May it please the court, David Hudson, Assistant District Attorney, arguing on behalf of Tarrant County, Justices Walker, Meyer, and McCoy. Good morning.
Morning.
This case is here before the Court of Appeals because of a historical fact that's fundamental, which is reflected in the record. Deborah Lynn McQuarrie, the plaintiff in this case, was a Sheriff's Department employee who was subject to the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department civil service rules, and so her employment began with a six-month probationary period. When she ultimately was terminated at the end of her probationary period, several months later, she filed a lawsuit, which was a federal predecessor to this particular lawsuit, and for the first time, she claimed to have been terminated due to whistleblowing. Sheriff Anderson, who was the arbiter under the civil service appeal process in Rule 8.8 of the civil service rules, which applied to a probationary employee whose probationary employment was terminated, he was immediately and totally surprised because he had no previous concept that she had made any reports of law violations or what she considered to be law violations, and no concept that she believed or had claimed or would be claiming such a status. And we have an uncontested applicable procedure under Rule 8.08, and there had been an appeal where Ms. McQuarrie had gone through that process and submitted a couple of pieces of writing and had a meeting with the sheriff. So he was surprised to have no prior notice of this. So it was his lack of notice that led to this plea to the jurisdiction, and now we're on interlocutory appeal. What I want to do in my time is briefly discuss the trial court's actions and the rationale that the trial court wrote about, and then talk about, I think, the three issues that you have to think through in order to analyze this, which is there a reasonable notice content requirement from 554006 of the government code at all? Second of all, what can we glean from the content of what she did say in her administrative procedure? And third of all, what about the Rivera case, which provides some kind of an administrative exception or an equitable exception to a reasonable notice requirement? Now, the trial judge perceived a factual conflict, but I think the important thing here is to look at what is the relevant legal issue? And there's really only two relevant legal issues. One is, did Ms. McQuarrie provide reasonable notice to a reasonable employer of a potential whistleblower claim? That comes right out of the Robeson case and the Ender case. And the second question under Rivera would be, was she effectively thwarted by the actions of the employer from giving such a reasonable notice? And the trial judge formulated the legal issue in the letter that he wrote in two different ways that are a little bit inconsistent with each other, and neither of them stated the correct legal standard. If you look at the correct legal standard, as I've stated it, the relevant material evidence is all undisputed. The dispute is, how do you interpret the law, and how do you apply that law to these particular facts? Now let's look at the first question of reasonable notice under 554006. The plaintiff would say, well, there's really two reasons that there is no reasonable notice requirement. The plain language of the statute doesn't speak to it, and there's the Smith case out of the Beaumont Court of Appeals, which purports to hold that it's not required. Now, the problem with the plain language argument is that it really leads to a process that doesn't make sense, and it leads to an absurd interpretation of the statute. even right in the statute, in Section B of the statute, the timing of the required invocation of procedures is tied to when the whistleblower violation occurs or when the whistleblower violation is reasonably discovered. So even right there in the statute, there seems to be a contemplation that whistleblower is going to come up somewhere in the required prerequisite. And second of all, you have two cases, Robeson and Ender, from the Austin Court and the Eastland Court, which hold in the opposite direction from what Smith purports to hold and say that there is a requirement of reasonable notice. And they cite the purposes of the statute. The purposes of 554.006 are said to be early discovery and an early opportunity for remediation.
Well, tell me how your wording be implicitly.
Well, I wouldn't say so much that B directly speaks to content, but it does tie the requirement of 554.006 to a whistleblower violation. The timing is tied to the whistleblower violation. So I think there's a contemplation there that the whistleblower violation is going to be involved in the appeal, not that the appeal is going to be completely about other things and not mention the whistleblower violation. It just doesn't make sense to have a prerequisite to suit that doesn't mention the central issue between the parties. And Robeson and Ender hold as such. The Smith case, when you look at it, the statement that purports to be a holding is really overbroad, because the Smith case wasn't about, if you have an appeal, what kind of content do you have to have in the appeal? The question in the Smith case was, what was at issue was a reassignment and a termination. Was it even reasonable to see the submission of the employee as an appeal of either one of those things? And the Beaumont court said, no, it wasn't, because all the employee said was, I'd like you to recalculate my severance pay. And that wasn't seen as even being an appeal of the actions that were later sued on in the whistleblower case. So the formulation in Smith as to the content test, I think, really amounts to dicta. And so it's not the quality of precedent that Robeson and Ender are. Finally, you have the logical policy argument. Maybe we could concede that communication is a two-way street in an administrative process. And maybe there's some obligation of an employer, once the employer receives certain minimal notice, if he wants to know more, to ferret out that information. But if the employee doesn't have any burden at all to come forward with at least initial reasonable notice, then the employee is free to use what I'd call her carrots or her non-adversarial or her nicey-nice type arguments in the administrative phase, and she can save her big stick whistleblower for later. And that's not what the legislature contemplated as discussed in case law, which talk about the purposes of that statute. The second thing is, what's the content of her administrative notice? Well, it's important to note that she doesn't even argue to this court that what she did say gave reasonable notice of a whistleblower claim. But it's important to see that what she submitted said a whole lot of things. It's not that she was unable in the process to convey ideas or contentions to the sheriff. In my brief, I enumerate 9 separate things that she said in the 2 writings that she submitted. And some of those enumerations you could easily break up into several parts. And so I think it's fair to say she communicated nearly a dozen different ideas along the lines of why she should keep her job, why it would be unfair for her to lose her job. But none of them would give notice to a reasonable employer that she feels she's being retaliated against, or that she's made law reports or what she considers to be violations of legal duties that have led to her termination. And then finally, you come to the Rivera equitable exception. Rivera is a situation where equity demanded a remedy because the process itself was explicitly for the employee to have a meeting with her principal and to have it within 10 days. And the record in the Rivera case was that that employee repeatedly sought to have that meeting over the 10 days and repeatedly was denied the possibility of having the meeting. And the way that that's formulated by the 14th Court in Rivera is that the employer effectively thwarted the employee's ability to participate in the process, and the employer can't take advantage of a process that it's effectively thwarted in the first place. And another way to put that is, under those facts, it was impossible for the employee to actually participate in the process because the process itself was a meeting.
Well, how do you address her complaint that Chief Knowles had told her not to put anything in writing, basically to be very careful in what she put in writing, and she wanted to keep her job, so she was reluctant to put in writing these complaints, and then when she had her face-to-face meeting and brought her notes, that Sheriff Anderson indicated that he was in a big hurry and only could give her a couple minutes?
Well, the way I would address that, I think there's two parts to that answer. First of all, with respect to what Chief Knowles said, he didn't say, don't put anything in writing. He said, we must be very careful what we write to the sheriff. And you have to look at the timing of that. The timing of that is about December 29th, right at the start of her employment. And the timing of the appeal is in June. So it's a six-month difference, all the way from the very beginning of her employment to the end of the employment. And second of all, if she felt that there was some type of an order not to say sensitive things, not to say adversarial things, not to say controversial things, you can see from the two writings that she submitted that that situation had evaporated or changed by the time she wrote her appeal. Because when she wrote her appeal, she came forward and said, I didn't get evaluated like I should have gotten evaluated. She said, Chief Knowles told me to disregard my job description. She said, I went to another chief, and he told me to keep a record of that. She said that she didn't have any hard feelings toward Chief Knowles, implying that whatever the problems were with him, that there had been some problems. She was able and willing and actually did put all kinds of sensitive and controversial things. And we're not saying that she had to use magic words, and we're not saying that she had to plead her whole whistleblower case. One line would have been sufficient to give notice. If she had said, I just think this is happening to me because I wouldn't play ball, or I just think this is happening to me because I didn't want to tolerate what John Peter Smith was doing, that would have done it. It doesn't have to be elaborate notice. It just has to be reasonable notice that gets the idea across. And she just didn't do that. She had plenty of reasonable opportunity to do that. We'll concede that at that particular meeting with the sheriff, arguably she may have been thwarted at that particular meeting. But the process was much broader than that meeting. The process included the ability to submit anything she wanted in writing. She had actually previously submitted two things. She never explains whether she asked for an additional meeting, or why she couldn't, or why she didn't leave the notes, despite the fact that the sheriff might have had to go at that time, or why she didn't make a copy of the notes and provide them later, or why she didn't create a third document that more fully said everything she wanted to say.
So you're saying she could have submitted something even after the meeting?
She could have. Even under the limited time frame of the 5 days of the process, there were several days left. And as we all know, the law would allow her more than that time frame anyway. But there's no evidence of any pre-litigation notice whatsoever. And that's just what there has to be, unless you're in that impossibility situation. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
May it please the court.
I don't anticipate using all of my argument time here today, but
you've heard that
y'all might start. Yeah, you've heard that before. I understand. And I will start backwards and move forwards from counsel's argument, and I will discuss the factual disputes first and the Miranda decision from the Texas Supreme Court and how I believe that affects the situation at hand. To paraphrase and in a nutshell, I think the county's argument and the counsel's argument is essentially she tried, but she should have tried harder. And to me, that in itself creates the fact issue with respect to jurisdictional issues. I believe that the trial court saw that, and that's the reason he denied the plea to the jurisdiction. Essentially, I'm not sure, he just gave an example of things she could have done. But the law doesn't require her. At that point, it becomes, well, what's enough? Is six times enough? If she went to the sheriff's house and knocked on the door, is that enough? It's analogous to me to a mitigation of damages issue,
I think what their position is that she had a burden sometime during the appeal process to let them know that she felt that she had been terminated or was being terminated because of reporting of unlawful conduct, you know, under the whistleblower, so that if they wanted to reconsider their position or her termination in light of that, they would have had that opportunity.
And maybe that is their baseline position is that. And we would argue that the facts, which are in dispute, and in the clerk's record and in the summary or the plea to the jurisdiction evidence, which I sometimes refer to as summary judgment evidence in this case because that's somewhat the way it's viewed, she specifically states that she attempted to make that the sheriff absolutely refused to listen to the statements and walked out of the meeting. That's the exact quote. He refused to listen to such statements and left the meeting. And I believe that the trial court viewed that as, and likewise he said, I never heard anything that made me think any otherwise. And I understand that he has his position and she has her position. I believe that's where ultimately the trier of fact will have to determine both the credibility of the witnesses.
And where in the record is what she told Sheriff Anderson, which prompted him to walk out of the meeting so that we could say, aha, here's where she told Sheriff Anderson.
In the clerk's record at page 12, I believe, which is her affidavit, she states, and I'll...
I advise Sheriff Anderson I had no hard feelings? It's got to be something more than that.
I'm sorry, clerk's record 34.
All right.
She attempted to explain in detail to the sheriff the problems and issues she was having during her employment. He refused to listen to any such statement and just walked out and said, quote, he would look into it. I believe that infers that there was at least the initiation of those discussions, and when every inference is given to the plaintiff, as in this case, and every inference is to determine jurisdiction, all reasonable inferences are to be go towards that nature. I believe that provides some of the detail that you're asking for.
But in light of her prior submissions, her prior two writings that she submitted, which didn't say anything about whistleblower or anything related to whistleblower,
that is correct,
conduct,
Your Honor.
How can that inference arise?
I will state that her job description involved the reference When the trial court looked at it, the reference to her ignoring her job description was very important because part of her job description, according to the summary judgment evidence that and the plea to the jurisdiction evidence that was put on, was supposedly to ensure the compliance with the laws related to inmates and health care. And so the reference that she was in order to ignore her job description could be inferred to deal with that direct issue with regarding the legal treatment or the health care treatment and the legal implications of that with inmates at the Tarrant County Jail.
Okay, I'm still not following you. I'm not following how we're getting to an inference that she tried to tell Sheriff Anderson about whistleblower conduct.
Well, other than her exact statement that she tried to discuss those issues and he refused to listen to him.
But what are those issues? You're asking us to infer that those issues are...
Well, if you look earlier in her affidavit, she talks about her... When those issues refers back to all of her whistleblower complaints and the problems she was having with Chief Deputy Knowles, that when she says, detail the problems and issues I was having during my employment, the whole earlier area of that affidavit deals exclusively with the issues of reporting legal violations, being told that, one, not to put anything in writing to the sheriff, two, to ignore her job description.
Which could also infer that it's expanded, not contracted.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If I told you to ignore your job description, there could be an equal inference that I was expanding your responsibilities, not contracting them.
That I could understand how you would see that, but in conjunction with the affidavit, that statement comes directly after her complaining about TB screening and the TB screening that was going, or actually the destruction of TB screening records at the jail, and in response to that concern of hers, the response was, you need to just ignore your job description. And so while I understand what Your Honor is saying, I think that under that scenario, it's a direct reference to legal violations going on at the Tarrant County Jail. Ignore your job description is the next statement. And certainly I believe in that sense, in that situation, an inference could be drawn that that's, you're being told to also ignore legal violations.
You think that we're supposed to be looking from the eyes of Sheriff Anderson as to whether he was informed of whistleblowing activity, or we're supposed to be looking from her eyes toward Sheriff Anderson? Because you got to remember what Sheriff Anderson had in front of him, and so it seems to me that any inference that we draw from her affidavit has to look at what Sheriff Anderson had and what he may have inferred from what she was telling him.
And from their meeting on the, I believe, the 12th.
Yes.
I might have been the 9th. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And I believe that as a matter of law, when viewing these pleas to the jurisdiction, that every inference should be given, first, due to the remedial nature of the statute, every inference should be towards jurisdiction. Second, due to the fact that it takes on a quasi-summary judgment-esque standard, that also in that situation things should be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and therefore I think it should be from her eyes that we view this meeting, especially the meeting. I, as counsel said, there's essentially no dispute. I mean, the documents are what the documents are as far as what she submitted prior to the meeting. The real factual dispute becomes what was said at the, you know, what happened at the meeting, whether she put him on notice or attempted to put him on notice. And I don't believe putting him on notice is what the statute requires. According to the Rivera case, there's also, you know, additional cases, the University Medical Branch of Galveston at Homan and the Upton County versus Brown case also are cases where there's really no indication that at the grievance procedure that they put them on notice of the whistleblower claims at that time, or that they, and this goes back to the Beaumont case that counsel was discussing earlier, as far as how do we read this statute. And from a statutory basis, and I know I've worked backwards in time here, but just at the first statutory look at the statute, I don't see how, if the legislator wanted to include a simple statement and said include all whistleblower claims within this grievance process, it could have done so. It's a simple, it could be a comma, and include all whistleblower claims they have knowledge of at that time, or something along those bases, and it simply didn't do so. But going back to your question, I believe that it should be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff through her eyes under this scenario.
What about the reasonable man standard? Neither of the other two?
I believe that it should be viewed in her light most favorable to her. I also believe that as far as the Rivera case and their attempt to distinguish it, I think it's a distinction without relevance, to be honest with you. I think that In that case, yes, she went three or four times. And this goes back to my mitigation of damages argument. You know, what is the appropriate, what, under the scenario, under this scenario where there's no real, there's a vague standard, the statute doesn't give her any other guidance with respect to that, but the appeal procedure within the civil service rules was very vague. What standard do you hold that person to as far as bringing forth their whistleblower complaints? And I think an attempt to do that, that it's rebuked, satisfies that from a, both a case law standpoint and a statutory standpoint. And any whether that was met or not is ultimately up for the trier of fact. If the trier of fact, and this goes back to the mitigation of damages argument, if they determined that, you know, is going out and seeking five jobs within a six-month period adequate? Probably not. Is going out and doing 10 jobs? I don't know. That's up for the trier of fact to determine. You know, getting on Google versus actually going down to the Texas Workforce Commission. All those things come into play when determining whether a person has effectively tried to protect their rights or protect their livelihood in the sense of mitigation damages.
What do you think the purpose of the grievance procedure is?
That grievance procedure? Or the grievance procedure under the statute?
The one we're talking about here.
The civil service? To me, all it says is if you're not happy with the fact that you're this is during the for a probationary employee, at the end, if you're determined that they're going to end your probation, that you have a right to complain about the fact that they ended your probation and are not going to make you a full-time employee. Just as the statute says and the Beaumont case says, you have to put them on notice. You're complaining about the decision itself, not the basis for the decision itself. And I think that's all that says, is that you need to let us know what your problem, what issue you, or what decision you have an issue with.
Does that really make any sense? That all you have to do is tell them that I'm complaining you fired me, and not tell them why you're complaining about why you fired me, so that they may can reconsider?
I guess at some point, if you have a full, and with respect to some of the case law that's been cited here, the Ender decision out of Austin, those involved full evidentiary hearings where these people were able to express their grievances. There's no indication that initially they were able to put in writing. In fact, in the Farrar case out of City of Austin, it specifically did not come up into any of the written documentation. And then they got into a full evidentiary hearing, and then there was one reference to, I think this is they're mad at me because I complained about legal violations, and the court there determined that, was sufficient enough to invoke the protection under the whistleblower statute. If these people under the situation were given a full hearing or any kind of grievance panel or anything like that, it might be different, but they've set up a system whereby which there's one arbiter. You have to go to that arbiter. If he doesn't want to listen to what you have to say, their argument is you have to try harder. I don't believe that is indicative of what the law would call for. I think once you've attempted to invoke those rights and they're rebuked, you've triggered the statute, and that's essentially the dispute between the parties here at this point, is whether that effectively triggers the statute or not. Because when you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to her, she did attempt, it was rebuked, or he walked out and refused to, quote-unquote, refused to listen, and that was the end of the, and I used the quotes in my brief, the appeal hearing, because it's not really an appeal hearing when the same person's making the same decision twice.
It seems to me the difference in y'all's position is you're saying, I'm putting you on notice that I want to explain to you why you've made a mistake, and their position is, I'm not only putting you on notice, but here is why, in my notice, why you made a mistake.
And it's also correct, though, that, and they concede that she could have brought that forward in any form and fashion at that meeting, but then they've conceded that she did not have to put that in the written notice. She was not required to. The civil service rules don't require her to put anything other than that she's appealing the decision in her and her termination appeal, and they concede that she could have brought forth any and all of these complaints in a face-to-face meeting with the sheriff, which she attempted to do, and they acknowledge she attempted to do that. They just disagree with the sheriff's reaction.
What's your explanation for a lack of follow-up? Go ahead and answer.
A lack of follow-up with respect to... Well, the decision had been final. She received, I believe, 2 days later before that the decision would stand, and she sought out prior counsel at that point who, within the 90 days, mind you, under the went ahead and filed, which could be argued that was the notice of the whistleblower complaints, but within the 90 days filed her complaints, and ultimately, first in federal court, which ultimately was removed or remanded back to state court.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly, you've managed to use all your time.
I know. I apologize.
No. Thank
you. I didn't know that was going to answer so many questions. Thank you.
Just a couple of points in reply quickly. With respect to her efforts, the trial judge wrote that there was a factual dispute as to whether she tried. Well, whether she tried is not the issue unless you're at the situation where she's so effectively thwarted as to make it impossible. So that's not really the correct legal issue. And she testified that she tried based on what was in her mind. The sheriff hasn't contradicted that, and he's in no position to contradict that. He doesn't know what was in her mind. But that's not really the issue. The issue is, what did she do? And the correct standard is a reasonable employer in Sheriff Anderson's position. Now, all she has to do is get across one line. One sentence could have done it. It can be verbal, it can be written, and it's just not there in any part of the process. Let me point out one case that's not in my brief that's pending on rehearing. It's from another court of appeals. It's the Aguilar case out of El Paso, with the site 2009 Westlaw 2357139. The Aguilar case is another case which says content of a 554006 appeal matters. In the Aguilar case, the plaintiff did file an administrative appeal in a desire to check off that box and have it done. And then there was some type of an arbitration proceeding and questions were asked. And the plaintiff said, well, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm saving that for litigation. And the Aguilar case says, no, you can't do that because that thwarts the purpose. You can't have discovery and early conciliation pre-litigation if you don't know about the whistleblower issue. So Aguilar fits in with Robeson and Ender. And I also think that there's really been no argument as to how you distinguish the Robeson case. The Robeson case is just amazingly similar. Again, you have a nursing employee who's losing her job, and she has extensive communications with her employer setting forth multiple arguments as to why she should keep her job and multiple arrangements as to how in the future she might be able to keep her job. Could I take my husband's job and he could leave because they both work for the same employer? It's a lot like what the plaintiff said in this case when she said, can I go from being jail medical liaison to being liaison for the whole department? Can I have you, Sheriff Anderson, supervise me instead of Chief Knowles? There's lots of communication, but there's nothing that puts a reasonable employer on notice. And really, the interpretation of the law and the handling of the facts in the Robeson case makes sense, and I don't really see how you distinguish that from this particular case.
Mr. Hudson, you start out your summary of argument with a statement that the jurisdictional prerequisites of the Texas Government Code 554.006 that a whistleblower's pre-suit initiation or invocation of applicable administrative procedure must provide employee with sufficient notice. That's your words.
Yes, sir.
Where is that in the statute?
It's not there in the statute. It's in the cases.
And it's your interpretation of the case law looking at this, coupled with the very broad language in 8.08 on the notice of appeal of failure to complete probation.
Yes.
Couples with the determination that you must outline at the start of your notice the things that you're going to talk about in your appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that in 8.08, there's no requirement for writing, there's no requirement for a hearing, there's no requirement for a face-to-face meeting, but all of those things are allowed for. It's simply a matter of employee, present your contentions, sheriff, present your reply.
And my concern is that you're mixing the procedures under the civil service rules on appeal with jurisdictional questions in the aspect of what you're required to do under the 554.006 to merely attain jurisdiction in the court. That's what we're talking about. I don't see how those two fit hand in glove, and especially not with an argument that you're required to marshal all of your items you want to talk about in your appeal hearing in your notice. It just doesn't seem to get there.
Well, again, sir, I don't think there's any requirement in 8.08 that you marshal all your arguments in writing. It's simply 554.006 requires you to participate in any kind of applicable appeal or grievance procedure. This is an applicable appeal or grievance procedure. It was a termination at the end of probation. Ms. McQuarrie saw it as that. That's what the document said that it was. And it's really quite a low standard. She doesn't have to marshal all her evidence. She doesn't have to plead her whole case. She just has to say something. And again, it could be in one sentence, which conveys to a reasonable employer, there's a whistleblower issue here. It doesn't have to develop the whistleblower issue or argue it, but just enough so the employer could know what he's dealing with.
And it's not an issue that the time frames in 554.006 were met.
Well, the time frame in 554.006, according to the case law, is going to be the whole 90 days before a lawsuit can be filed.
Not an issue here. That there,
not
that
an issue because there's no evidence of any pre-litigation notice whatsoever.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted.